Before we get into today's episode, I want to let you know about a source of powerful free resources to help you as a parent or grandparent get equipped to invest in the faith of the next generation. Our Next Gen website has been designed to help empower you to navigate tough issues with the young people in your life. At Next Gen, you'll find articles, entertainment reviews from a Christian perspective, parenting stories, helpful parenting guides, and even answers to the tough questions. All these resources are free as you engage on the front line of raising the next generation for Jesus. So why not register today at premierinsight.org/resources to receive free resources from NextGen. That's premierinsight.org/resources. And now it's time for today's podcast.
Understand, defend, and share your faith with confidence. This is Unapologetic from Premier Unbelievable.
Thank you for joining us on Unapologetic. I'm Ruth Jackson. And before we hear from today's guest, just a quick reminder to visit premierunbelievable.com for more shows, articles, and resources. And you can also register there for the chance to win a free book. And if you enjoy listening to Unapologetic, then please do consider rating and reviewing it on your podcast platform. But now for today's show. I am delighted to be joined today by Aaron Arora, the Bishop of Kirkstall in the Diocese of Leeds and the Honorary Canon of Ripon Cathedral. Aaron has written the excellent book, Stick With Love, which is the Archbishop of York's Advent book for this year. Aaron, you cite a really interesting poll in your book conducted in 2004 to determine the greatest black icon of all time. Would you just say a little bit about that? Because I thought, you know, who topped it was fascinating.
It was a poll run by New Nation newspaper, which is a newspaper predominantly aimed at African-Caribbean communities in Britain. And they ran a poll for the greatest black icon of all time. And the competition was fierce. And within the top 10, Nelson Mandela, Muhammad Ali, Oprah Winfrey, Mary Seacole, who just not long before that poll had been voted the greatest black Briton in a poll run by the BBC for the wonderful thing that she did in nursing. But at the top, and the winner by a country mile, was Jesus. And I think a lot of people found that surprising. Because when they picture Jesus, they don't picture someone who's black. But of course, we know that Jesus coming from the Middle East and born in the Middle East wouldn't have been unlikely to have been blue-eyed, blonde-haired and fair-skinned. And yet that is the image, of course, born of the Renaissance that we have in most of our churches here in England.
And so do you think Jesus was black? And I suppose, even more importantly, do you think it matters?
I think one of the implications of how we picture who Jesus was relate to the incarnation, to what Jesus looks like. No. The incarnation is a huge game changer in our understanding of the world, in our understanding of God. God physically takes on human flesh. As we read at the start of John's Gospel at Christmas and enters human history. And I think some of the impact that that might have when we try to picture what Jesus looks like could be, for instance, how slave traders viewed the chattels they were buying and selling in Bristol, in Liverpool, in London, in Cardiff. Would it have made a difference to them, I wonder, if having sold women and men on Saturday, they then went to worship on Sunday and looked up and saw in that stained glass an image of Jesus that looked remarkably like the chattel they had sold the previous day? I think it makes a difference potentially in how we treat one another, in recognizing the image of God. in one another.
Yeah, you've got a wonderful line which summarizes what you've just said in the book. You say, images of Christ reflecting the very physicality of his incarnation have the power to inform not only how we understand God, but also how we treat one another. And I think that summarizes it so beautifully. I mean, you share some really harrowing stories of some of your experiences of people asking you things, particularly in services when you were speaking as a guest speaker. I mean, why is asking someone where they're really from so, so deeply offensive, Aaron?
It's, in some ways, there's a natural politeness, you know, that all of us have experienced in coffee time after church. When, you know, if you see someone new, and you go up and, oh, I haven't seen you before, where are you from, that kind of thing. But then I think when you are, or for me, I know it's not just my own experience, but for me as someone who is not white, who's an Asian man, where are you from carries with it an undercurrent of otherness that seeks to distinguish rather than unify, a sense of, because where are you from? And sometimes I'll say, oh, I'm from Birmingham, and that's enough. And then they know, no, but where are you really from? And I'll say, oh, I'm really from Birmingham, you know, in that sense of laying it on and proving it. But then they're, no. Where are you originally from? And within that, I'm not in that suggesting somehow that they, those asking the question, are of bad faith or of bad heart. You know, perhaps they're seeking to direct the conversation to the fact that once they've been to India, or, you know, or try and tell a story of something linked to the colour of my skin. But the focus is always then on my otherness, on the colour of the skin, on the fact that I'm different. And part of the unease about that is that, you know, moments earlier we would have celebrated together, say, in the Eucharist, our commonality in Christ, our identity in Christ, our common identity as sisters and brothers. And then all of a sudden, you know, almost 10 minutes later, that unity, that oneness is replaced by almost a re-emphasis of distinctions that we see in the world, be that distinctions of colour, class, background, whatever it might be. So the unease that's associated with that question, and I think perhaps, and I mentioned this reading the book, the most extreme example came when I just preached and presided at a service, filling in for a holidaying clergyman, where at the end, the question wasn't even, where are you from, but what religion are you? And now,
I know, I had to laugh so hard when I could not believe that.
It could have been that, you know, it really was a quite damning critique of my sermon that day. And maybe, you know, maybe it was
what
so
does
poor,
this man believe?
Well, it was so poor that he just thought, you know, what is this nonsense? But the fact that I had then celebrated communion, spoken the words of Jesus, shared with him the body and blood of Christ and declared together our common creed. But that all of that seemed secondary to the colour of my skin, which meant that somehow, because I'm Asian, I must be Muslim or Hindu or Sikh, because, you know, Asian Christians does not compute.
So how do we change that narrative? Because we cannot carry on like that, can we?
I think there has been some progress. I think we're now in a position, say, and I can talk about the Church of England in this context. We've talked about in Lament to Action, which was, I was the co-author of that report around how the Church of England can begin to address issues of racism, both institutional racism and otherwise within its own ranks. But really at the heart of that is a call to be more, a call for the church, not just the Church of England, but the church as a whole, to be a place of justice for anti-racism within wider society, to be the city on the hill, to be the light that shines, that guides others. So within the Church of England, we've made some progress. We now have, in the whole language of needing to see it, to be it, in terms of participation of diverse voices, we now have more bishops from global majority backgrounds than we've ever had. At the most senior level, at the diocesan level, we're still where we were 20 years ago with two. I don't think there's ever been more than two diocesan bishops from global majority heritage, at 42, that is, in our history. And to that extent, and that first happened about 25 years ago. So we're back up to that level. That's good. Hopefully it will progress. More readily, I think it's about looking at our practices and putting into place some of the recommendations that have been made over the past 30, 40 years in various reports to General Synod that have basically not been acted upon, where we've all said, yes, yes, of course we're all against racism. Yes, yes, it's terrible. But when it comes to, okay, so this is what we need to do to change this, those things haven't happened. That's changing. And some of those actions are now happening. And that's really positive. There is progress. It's not arguably quite enough. And it's not moving as fast as it should. But it's a start.
You're listening to Unapologetic from Premier Unbelievable.
This podcast is an outreach of Premier Insight, and it's made possible through the support of listeners like you. And your support today is so vital. We want to thank you for your generous gift by giving you exclusive access to Science, Faith and the Evidence for God Apologetics course. This 9-module course invites you to learn from John Lennox, one of the most celebrated Christian thinkers of our time, through conversations with atheist thinker Michael Ruse and secular talk show host Dave Rubin. You'll be empowered to confidently speak into conversations on faith, science, and why believing in God is not only reasonable, but logical. The course is free to you to thank you for your gift to help Premier Insight equip more Christians to confidently speak into the biggest issues of our culture and defend their Christian faith with conviction and grace. To get access to Science, Faith, and the Evidence for God, simply go to premierinsight.org/unbelievableshow. That's premierinsight.org/unbelievableshow. Unbelievable show. Thank you for your support.
You mentioned there the Lament to Action report, which that came out of the anti-racism task force, the Archbishop's anti-racism task force that you were co-chair of back in 2021. I mean, how did that come about? How was that task force formed and how did you get involved, Aaron?
I think part of it was what was the Church of England asking itself, as many institutions and organisations did, how they responded to the impact of the murder of George Floyd, the subsequent actions in Black Lives Matter, which all really shone a light, I think, on institutions saying, how do we deal with racism? How do we treat Black and Asian, global majority heritage women and men who come to us or who are part of us? And I think the House of Bishops and the Archbishops of Canterbury and York recognised that the Church of England wasn't doing great in this. No. And part of the task force that they established, and they asked me to be a member of, was to try and set out what we could do as a church to start addressing this. And one of the things that has happened as a result, there's now a Racial Justice Commission that's looking particularly at areas like monuments, like theology, post-slavery reparations, different issues, complaints procedures, some really practical things. And to say, how can we really address what we're doing in these areas and the way that either racism has been at work or how, and even if it comes to things like our different reading and theology, how we can begin to be open to different voices, to recognise that there's more. I think somebody I know put it, that when it comes to theologians, there's more than dead white German men when it comes to how we come to understand our Bible, how we come to reading it, that actually there are wider voices of different experience who are as equally intent in their study and knowledge of God, who bring different things to the table.
I mean, I guess lots of what you're talking about there is sort of high level Church of England wide, you know, things to be able to put into place. But what can church communities and individuals be doing to help bring about racial justice, do you think?
I think at its heart, it's about recognising that racism is a sin. That this isn't something that we do because it's politically correct or because it's the latest fad or trend or wokiness. But racism is a sin. It's evil. Galatians 3:28 tells us that we are all one in Christ, that there is no male, female, slave, free, Jew, Gentile, that actually we are one in Christ. And if we deny that, we are denying Christ's saving work. We are denying the meaning of the gospel. We are denying of what it is to be born again into a new identity in Christ when we come to faith. And so actually opposing racism, and this is what I think is central to the what you asked, it's about being intentionally anti-racist, which is the same as saying being intentionally pro-gospel. And that means I think the church, potentially the opportunity for the church, is to be the go-to people when it comes to justice. There is no national organization or body in England now whose job it is to lead on issues of racial justice. Years ago, there was the Commission for Racial Equality. Locally, there were race equality councils. They've all been abolished with the establishment of the single human rights body that looks now after the whole of equality and diversity. So gender, age, sexuality, religion and belief. But it means there is now a vacuum in society around whose job is it to promote racial justice. And because there is no individual body or organisation, particularly in England, I think that's an opportunity for the church to say, we can be the people who are the justice people, not just on this, but yes on this. So when we think of Martin Luther King, when we think of Desmond Tutu, when we think of Christian women and men who have led Rosa Parks, people who have led in this area, they've done so out of faith, out of their commitment to Jesus. And you don't need to be a person of colour to be anti-racist. You don't need to be, you don't need to have experienced racism to fight against it. Because in fighting against it, you're taking up the shield of the gospel. And so that really is the call. It's a call of discipleship.
Aaron, why is Christmas an important time to be having these conversations around race? And how do we ensure that it's not just conversations, but actually that leads to action?
I think part of it goes back to what we're talking about in terms of the incarnation. At Christmas, we do mark the entering of God into human history in an occupied territory, occupied by the Romans. As he comes powerless, as he comes frail, as he comes fragile. And God enters into human history. And that's why I think at that part, human experience, he elevates human experience by entering into it. And so I think that's why at Christmas, we really, mark that entering in, but also recognize the implications of that from that moment, that that moment changes everything. The incarnation changes everything. And I think that's why the implications of that in how we treat each other and what it means to treat other people less well, be that on the basis of their race, their gender, or whatever, that the incarnation is a reminder, Christmas is a reminder that we don't get to do that.
Thank you for listening to Unapologetic. I'm Ruth Jackson, and as always, you can find out more about our guests through the links with today's show. We would love to hear your feedback. Do drop us an email with your thoughts at unbelievable@premier.org.uk or get in touch via social media. And don't forget, there are more shows, articles and resources at our website, premierunbelievable.com. You can also register there for the chance to win a free book. That's premierunbelievable.com. And if you enjoy listening to Unapologetic, please do consider rating and reviewing it. Thank you for listening and see you next time.
You've been listening to Unapologetic. For more shows, resources and our newsletter, visit premierunbelievable.com.